The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting content from the December. We're going to wrap up the December 2025 issue of Southern Living Magazine. This week, we will hear the essay that ends that's on the back page of each issue, Southern Journal. Excuse me. And then we are going to we'll hear about Christmas at the Cleburne. This is a Houstonian buffet treat that is a Christmas tradition. And we'll hear about that in just a moment. All right. Are you ready? This is the Southern Journal on the back page of every one of the magazines. And incidentally, listeners, the cover of this magazine is a blush pink with a white frosted cake on it that has cookies representing famous doors in Charleston, or frosted cookies, doors that are around the bottom of the first layer of the cake. It's on a white pedestal plate. It's a light pink, a blush color pink. And it says, Southern Living, Home for the Holidays, the Magic of a Lowcountry Christmas. Mahogany cake with ermine frosting and Charleston door cookies. High spirits in Beaufort, South Carolina, which we got to in our last episode. Making merry at the Peabody Hotel. Fun and festive decor ideas, plus truffle pies and cookies. Oh, my. Rick Bragg's Southern Journal. Away in the manger, the comfort and joy of a humble nativity scene. And this begins, as always, with a cartoon picture. It's a drawing and a caricature of Rick Bragg. He's oversized in the picture. Rick Bragg has a receding brown hairline. He has brown hair, brown eyebrows, and white mustache and beard. He is leaning, his elbows are on the roof of a manger, a nativity scene. There is a church in the background, and the nativity scene, Rick Bragg has his chin, his face in his two hands, as his elbows that are in a gray long-sleeved button-down shirt are leaning on the top of that nativity scene. Rick Bragg's eyelids are closed because he's looking down at the nativity scene, and he has a very pleasant, placid smile on his face. The nativity scene, in contrast to Rick's gray and brown tones, the nativity scene has colors. The traditional characters are there, Mary, Joseph, and the baby, and are in the manger. And there are shepherds. One's carrying a sheep across his shoulders, rather large sheep. There's an angel with hands outstretched in prayer who's looking to the heavens in a long white gown. There are some sheep and a goat that are lying down, and a camel lying down. And then there's one camel that's walking with one of the three kings sitting upon it. And that king is wearing a red robe, and then there's a king walking beside him who's wearing a green robe with a purple cape, and they're holding boxes of red or blue. And there's another one of the three kings, is sitting down. He's on his knees beside his camel, who's also sitting on his knees. All right. I see the mangers every few miles, scenes molded in plastic and propped in yards. Like in the tale of the Grinch, I can almost feel my shriveled heart swell and thump in my chest each time. Some things just ride easy in my mind. Christmas parades, a lifetime past, still circle there. The fact that Santa Claus had to be dragged by a tractor did not make him any less real. Why they got to haul his sleigh on a flatbed trailer, I asked my mother 60 years ago. That's 'cause it ain't snowed, Mama replied, logically. It is the same feeling with greeting cards that have red birds on them, with snow sprayed from a can, and with Dean Martin, half drunk, singing Silent Night. But few things warm me like a nativity scene. I have long marveled at the magi, the shepherds, and the star of Bethlehem. And the story of Mary and Joseph, turned away from the inn and huddled with animals, was inescapable when I was a boy. They even told it on General Hospital. At Christmas, it seemed to me, even us sinners were part of it all. How could that not be if they cast the baby Jesus in polyurethane and constructed life-size mangers on the side of the road? Years later, I heard about something that made me certain of it. Barry Howard, a friend here in Alabama and a lifelong minister, became pastor at the historic First Baptist Church of Pensacola in 2005 and inherited, in a way, a story of hope that was born in tragedy. Back in 1971, longtime church members Francis and Elliot Doblestein lost their teenage son Wayne in a snorkeling accident in the Florida Keys during the Christmas season. The Doblesteins went down there to bring him back home. While there, Frances took a walk outside, her mind tortured. She came upon a manger scene like the countless ones she had seen before. But there was something about it, a kind of peace. She found comfort in it, said Pastor Howard. So, every year after that, for over three decades, she and her husband erected a nativity outside First Baptist Church of Pensacola. It became one of those traditions, those things that people like me come to rely on. But some folks are just Philistines. Vandals and delinquents would routinely swipe a shepherd, a wise man, or other figures. It got so bad that in 2007, Elliot chained baby Jesus in place. Then, one night, Pastor Howard said, they found the chain broken by bolt cutters and the baby missing again. It had to have been just pure meanness. When you steal Jesus, he said, what do you do with him? So they made an infant-shaped pile of straw and covered it with a blanket, and Christmas came and went. Then, on January 2nd, a staff member discovered the stolen Jesus at an entrance to the church. There was a note saying, I took this before Christmas and have not been able to sleep much since then. I am sorry. I shouldn't have done it, so I am bringing it back home. Like I said, even us sinners. For years longer, the Doblestein sponsored a smaller nativity in the church window, hoping, Pastor Howard said, that others would find peace in it, somehow. I saw a tiny manger scene once in a shoebox. It still made me smile. And that, listeners, is Rick Bragg's BRAGG Southern Journal for this month. And now we'll move on to Christmas at the Cleburne. For some Houstonians, home is where the buffet line is. And this is by Alana Al-Hatlami. And it begins with a double-page photograph that's on a kind of a light, very light mustard-colored tablecloth. and there are trays of the same color that kind of blend into the cloth. There are three of them, and they are placed vertically, the long sides by the long sides on left and right, and the short sides on top and bottom. From left to right, there's one tray has some baked ham, looks like honey baked ham, with pineapple, a pineapple slice in the center, and some Jell-O, looks like cherry Jell-O perhaps, and small plates around it, a small round plate of stuffing, small round plate of a carrot raisin salad, and then a small round plate with a slice of pecan pie. In the center tray, we've got a fried chicken on one of those red and white paper napkin gels and get your barbecue on. And it appears to be fried chicken. We'll find out later. It's got a lemon there and some tartar sauce. So that, excuse me, listeners, it's probably fried fish of some sort. And it is surrounded by round plates, five of them. One has some fried rice. Another has green peas and snap peas, green peas and red onions. Another has some white beans. Oh, no, those are black-eyed peas, some black-eyed peas. Then a string bean salad in another, the snake string bean salad with the fried onions. And then a pie of some sort, looks like some kind of a chiffon pie it appears to be. And then, finally, on the right, this tray has a turkey dinner upon it. Turkey with some white gravy, stuffing, and cranberries. And the six plates that's around this have some sweet potatoes sweet potatoes chopped. One has a pistachio-looking meringue with whipped cream and a blueberry and a slice of strawberry on it. One is bleeding off the page. It appears to be some kind of bread or a biscuit. One is mashed potatoes with brown gravy. One is green bean. And the other is pumpkin pie with some whipped cream along the rim of the circle, the outside of that wedge. And it begins here, our story, with a black and white photo, and it says, the original location. The restaurant began on Cleburne Street in 1941 and later relocated to its current spot on Bissonnette Street in 1969. Some loyal regulars have been stopping by since before the big move. Yeah, and there are some men in the front. This picture is in the 1940s, right, as it said. And it says Cleburne Cafeteria on the sign. Entrance on Cleburne. And there's another sign with an awning on the side of the building, because this is on the corner. It's a big brick building with pitched roofs and windows in the front. The storefront windows, floor to ceiling, have closed blinds, white blinds behind them. And it says, Cleburne, I can't quite read it, but it says open Sundays in very big letters. All right. It's December 23rd at the Cleburne Cafeteria in Houston, and a steady line is forming at the buffet as the sound of rocking around the Christmas tree rises just above customers' orders for chicken fried steak and meatloaf. And listeners, Cleburne is spelled C-L-E-B as in boy, U-R-N-E. A magazine-worthy tree adorned in golden maroon baubles greets guests who meander past a wall of paintings and photographs chronicling 84 years of the restaurant's history to get to the food. From the door to the register, folks neatly stack up between stanchions like they're going through airport security. but this line is tame, according to owner George Nicholas. He and his staff are enjoying the lull as they gear up for the next 2 days, which are some of the busiest of the year. The regulars. One of the Cleburne's most loyal congregants, Ken Topping, is already seated when I arrive a few minutes after opening. He is nestled in a booth, his tray stacked so deep with vegetables, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, yams, and spinach, that I mistake him for a vegetarian. I travel around the country, dining out all over the place. There is no restaurant like this anywhere, he says. I bring up Luby's, a well-known Texas cafeteria chain that has also existed since the 1940s. I might as well be cheering for a rival football team. To him, there is no comparison, especially on the fresh veggies. The food isn't the only draw here. For many of the regulars, there is a familial connection. My mom has been coming to Cleburne's for as long as it has been open, since the original construction, says diner Nicholas Senkel. The cafeteria debuted in 1941, relocated to its current address on Bissonnette Street in 1969, and has survived not one but two fires. Every Sunday we were at church, and every Sunday we were hereafter, says Thankful. Now he does the same with his own kids. I think they look forward to this more than they do the service, he says with a laugh. On the other side of the dining room sits Michael Craig, a broad-shouldered lawyer who's been dining at the Cleburne for 25 years. I don't like the phase, but this place is completely different, he explains. He comes for the wild-caught salmon and the generous portions that would likely be sold for twice the price at other Houston restaurants. You'll find him eating at home on Christmas, having ordered the turkey from here so he doesn't have to do the cooking. Back in the day, I was a policeman and used to drive in the neighborhood. We stopped by once, and I have been coming ever since, Craig says. Then and now, the iconic spot is a go-to for local law enforcement, both active and retired, he tells me. No sooner have I jotted that thought down than Craig starts waiting over a man in athletic wear and a Nike baseball cap. Are you by yourself? He asks him. Troy Finner, the former Houston police chief and a regular since 1991, pulls out his earbuds to join us at our table. The Cleburne has always been a fixture in my life and my family's, he says. Echoing Topping, he promises that the vegetable sides are unbeatable. But with a little prodding, he admits the German chocolate cake, sold in almost brick-sized slabs, is truly his favorite item. I'm a short guy, unlike him, he says, gesturing toward Craig. So I gotta watch what I eat, because I don't want to roll out of here. The food. The Cleburne Cafeteria's menu offers a taste of your grandmother's cooking when you can't have it. A bittersweet comfort that many who find themselves visiting around the holidays, alone or otherwise, appreciate. The air is both joyous and a little heavy, but it's hard not to smile at the cubes of red and green jello jiggling on the buffet line. And listeners, we have a photo, small photo of three women in cafeteria-looking uniforms. They're black with white ground collars and white trim on their short sleeve. And the caption is, I'll have my usual. The menu is a vegetable lover's delight. Patrons stand in line to get fresh greens, squash, and more, all served in heaping spoonfuls by the friendly staff. These three women are all smiling, looking very happy as they are serving, spooning out vegetables of, as we mentioned earlier, greens and corn and yams and casserole-looking things, all sorts of vegetables and round plates that they're spooning out, and they are behind a glass screen. And they all have black hair that is put up and parted in the middle or on the side, but it's all up and away and off their faces and pinned back. All right, back to our article, listeners. Those treats, those jello treats, are in good company. There are lime sherbet-colored squares of congealed salads that would seem anachronistic anywhere else. Confetti-thin shaved carrot salad, hot cornbread baked every 30 minutes, and ham topped with a pineapple ring and a cherry as bright as Rudolph's nose. There's no consensus among the customers. Folks favor the liver and onions almost as often as the fried chicken. Turkey and dressing are on the menu year-round, not just at Thanksgiving. The bird is boiled, which might conjure images of something overcooked and dry, but it's ultra-tender and served blanketed in a gravy so tasty it would likely cover up a multitude of sins if it had to. Mounds of the vegetables that regulars rave about are found in a technicolor grid on a steam table. There are four kinds of potatoes: mashed, au gratin, baked, and new. And just as many bean options: pinto, navy, lima, and black-eyed peas. Plus southern staples like greens, okra, and buttered corn. If your tray isn't already overflowing, there's dessert. More than a few people drag the second tray through the line solely for the sweets. The chocolate icebox pies and lemon tarts both come highly recommended, but I side with Finner and grab the German chocolate cake. The classic is often attributed to a Dallas homemaker, Mrs. George Clay, and while she may or may not have invented it, the cleverness has perfected the form. The moist, richly chocolatey sponge speaks to their quality ingredients. Few restaurants, let alone cafeterias, use top-tier Nielsen Massey vanilla in their confections like this place does. It's also proof of the care and craft the kitchen puts into every item on the line. Cooks start at 5 a.m. to ensure everything is ready for customers when the doors swing open at 11. And some have close to 40 years' experience working there. Christmas Day goes by really fast, says Sonia Beltran, who started her job at the Cleverin straight out of high school. The holiday begins with her packaging pre-orders, some totaling over $1,000 in food, before readying the restaurant for folks dining in. It's far from a chore. She and many other employees say they really enjoy working on Christmas. We get to meet a lot of people that day, and then we have the rest of the night to spend with our families and loved ones, she says. And listeners, there's a full-page photo of the owners, and the caption is Power Couple. General Manager Tina Rodriguez and owner George McKellis keep this institution running. All right, so they're not both owners. She is the general manager. He is the owner. They are sitting corner. They're sitting catty-cornered to each other, but facing us at tables, cafeteria tables with wooden chairs. There's no one else here. This is just a shot of them. There's sunlight coming in through the ample windows, very wall-to-wall windows. And outside, we can see Cleburne on a white printing on a green sign. And there's greenery in the background of the windows that we can see. There's also a brick wall and a filled-in brick archway. Perhaps that was once a window or a door. And on the top of the, and there are some brick columns, and on top, the ceiling, is a wood-beamed ceiling, brown wood beams. and Tina Rodriguez and George McAllis. He's on the right. She's on our left. They're facing us. Ms. Rodriguez has black hair that's pinned back, red lipstick, small round diamond earrings, and she's wearing a red plaid, kind of a tartan plaid, sweater over a white shirt, round collared shirt. She has red nail polish on, and they both have what appears to be, yes, cups of coffee before them. And they're the standard salt and pepper shakers that you see at many diners, and packets of sugar in one of those white square containers. They're both smiling. Mr. McAllis is wearing white uniform that says Cleburne Cafeteria in at the chest placket. It's got double-breasted white buttons. It is a chef's shirt. It's short-sleeved. He's wearing a silver watch, and his arms are folded casually before him at the table. Also bright smiles. They both have bright smiles. Mr. McAllis is balding slightly, receding hairline, with dark hair, and he has a white mustache and white beard. Both have brown eyes and very, very pleasant smiles. All right. The owner. Back to our story. McAllis never stops moving around. He talks as he walks, bouncing along the black and white tiled floors of the entryway to the dining room, then the kitchen, and back. Having literally grown up in the world of hospitality, at one point when he was a kid, he lived above the original restaurant. There's an ease with which he navigates the controlled chaos of a busy service. He has a permanent smile and the telltale dark circles of an industry veteran. When asked how his family business came to be a holiday destination, his grin stretches wider as he says, "It started with an unlocked door." Technically, it all began in Greece. McAllis' father, Nick, emigrated from the island of Patmos to America after World War II. That's all the time we've got for today, listeners. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we hope you'll listen next time. I'm Joanna LaForge, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you.